How are you this fine evening?
I'm peachy. How are you, Dan?
Just gulp down another shot of this disgusting blue stuff that I got at Walgreens that really helps my throat feel better.
Okay.
It's cough syrup.
I was hoping it was that. I didn't know if it was going to be like one of those things that you get up near the counter where they come in the very colorful bottles.
Like an energy shot?
Yeah, like all that bizarro stuff.
No, that's for college kids.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't need that.
Fortunately, we're both too old for that. Too old for this.
Sure. Yeah, having a fun week.
Yeah, huge fun week.
Lot of overtime.
Yes. Let's not speak of that in much detail. But we are a day late because I was too pooped from working quite late into the evening on some, you know, task which shall remain nameless. Speaking of people that shall remain nameless, I wanted to highlight something that I read in the Hollywood Reporter. The headline here is Oscars 2015: Watch Emmanuel Lubezki's acceptance speech for achievement in cinematography. And then it goes on to show you his acceptance speech where he doesn't thank visual effects at all. And then there's the whole thing where it turns out that it was actually a studio commandment the studio and the director didn't want them to talk about the visual effects because it might ruin the magic of the moment during award season. But now that award season is over, they can talk to the Hollywood Reporter, which I thought was... poppycock.
This was a an article what came out like yesterday or something that was at least being passed around.
Yeah.
Where do we even start with this article? In months leading up to the Oscars, the filmmakers did acknowledge that editing and VFX were used to complete the illusion. Since the film was shot entirely with handheld cameras or with Steadicam, editing and VFX were necessary to bridge the transitions between the individual shots, but very little was disclosed about the amount of VFX work that went into the individual shots themselves. When asked for specifics, the editors or members of the VFX team said on more than one occasion that the director and studio wanted to maintain the, quote, magic, which is a nice way of saying, let's not let them know how much of this was built in post, because it's supposed to be this high-minded single-shot concept to match the fact that it's a play, and we're kind of playing off that same continuous scene thing.
Yeah, because if you let people know that people worked on it, it would ruin it. That's the whole point of an award season about people that work on things. So I have a couple major logical flaws with their thinking in withholding this information. Number one, the award season is about recognizing the talent that goes into working on these films. If you're going to give the film an award, then make sure you're giving the award to the everybody that worked on the film, and not just a subset of that film. This isn't an award season for the director and for the cinematographer and for the actors. This is an award season for everybody that worked on it. So to say that you don't want to talk. You didn't want the visual effects artists and the visual effects studio to discuss anything about what they did on the film, because it would ruin the magic of it. Means, please don't talk about this. We want people to think it was all visual trickery rather than actual work that was done to make this happen. Because in the past, the Academy has steered away from big special effects things, and it is even mocked in Birdman somewhat. Where visual effects is a no-no, and it's all about the purity of art and all this stuff. So to sort of like stifle and mask and hide how much of it was, you know, work that was done on it that would be impossible without the aid of visual effects is really irritating. You'll notice that Birdman is not up for visual effects. It wasn't in the Bake Off. It wasn't in the Oscars, and the ones that select for the Bake Off and the nominees that go get put forward, that's all handled by the actual members of that group in the Academy. So the visual effects artists kind of pick amongst themselves, and then it goes forth to the entire Academy, and they pick from that list. And so the Birdman didn't make it into the bake-offs, and Birdman wasn't up for it. So it wasn't like it was groundbreaking, amazing visual effects work on some sort of crazy scale. Like, this wasn't this wasn't some unimaginable feat in a certain way, but in another way it is, because it's an invisible effect that is not really supposed to be seen or perceived. And to mask that and to not give recognition or thanks for that, I think is hugely offensive. And to tell them that they can't talk about it is just absurd.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you on all of this. The fact that at no point did they really come out and at least give an appropriate level of praise to the people who did the post work on this movie is just unforgivable. I mean, there's so much work in this, and it's probably a little difficult for us because we are inside this particular field, and we know how much work has gone into it. Even just reading this description in the Hollywood Reporter article, I don't think people outside the Post industry are going to be able to extrapolate quite as well as we can about what all actually had happened here. But it is interesting in this article that it mentions 90 minutes of this 112-minute film went through a visual effects pipeline, which is an insane amount of work. I mean, even if it's just minor stuff here and there, that is a ton of work. But one thing that you brought up the bake-off that is worth bringing up just to talk about is when films do go into the bake-off, they're not allowed to show before and afters, and they're limited to what, like a 4 or is it like a 12-minute presentation. I wonder if there was some level of discussion about how, while visual effects are kind of the entire point of this movie's goofy little trick with the one shot, it's really kind of impossible to present that to the bake-off audience.
Well, it's my recollection that no package was put forward to the bake-off audience at all for Birdman, meaning that the studio's directors, the visual effects houses and stuff, they put together basically like a package that they screen, like you're saying, like for a few minutes of part of a movie or a few shots from a movie, to screen that right before everybody goes and they vote for the bake-off stuff to decide who gets to be on the short list that'll actually go before the entire Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences body to vote on, all the old white people, which ones they will get. So
all the old white people,
yeah, all the great old white people. But I don't remember them putting forth anything at all to get in for this, which isn't surprising if the studio didn't want them to. But that is kind of silly. And We have also talked a little around this, but the studio that actually did the work was Rodeo FX, and they're in they're a Montreal based company, so it's not like this was a big effects studio that always gets recognition or something. This wasn't ILM. This wasn't Rhythm and Hues. This wasn't DD. This wasn't DNEG. This wasn't Frame Store, none of that. This is a relatively small group. Paul Franklin of DNEG, the VFX supervisor from Interstellar, this year's winner, even tweeted, I'm going to read this one, "The seamless work in Birdman is outstanding. Like others in VFX, it took I took a look at the bid and thought, holy shit, that's going to be hard." And what he means by that is that They also did this on not a lot of money, because as we've discussed in previous podcasts, they bid on things in order to get the work, to do the work, and very low bids, very tiny amounts of money are of course something the studio desires and might push for. So the fact that he even commented on that, you know, that lets you know this is a small scale studio doing small scale stuff. That they pulled this off by themselves is a huge feat, and they got basically no recognition during award season. Now that award season has completely passed them by, they can talk about how they did it. And I think that is not very nice, to say the least.
Yeah, I mean, It's not really that difficult for folks inside the industry to figure out who did what, just because the way these bid things go around. But I imagine Rodeo would really want people to know that they worked on this, you know, for the future of their business, or just to stand on pride to say, like, yeah, we worked on this movie, and there's even more work in there than you would imagine, because we spent a lot of time on this and we're really proud of it. And it is kind of unfortunate that they weren't allowed to do that ahead of time. But, you know, the other thing about this that is like, probably the reason it grates on at least you and me so much is, you know, we've seen a couple little behind the scenes featurettes here and there, and just interviews where they're talking about, you know, how they had to use clever cuts and wipes to stitch between scenes. And okay, maybe there's this, we're dumbing down terminology for people who don't really care. But this article on Hollywood Reporter at least illustrates in one scene, they are, well, in multiple scenes, actually, it explains, they're mixing performances from multiple takes. So they're grabbing Ed Norton from one take and Michael Keaton from another take and putting them in the same shot together, which is in order of magnitude more difficult because this is all handheld work. So it actually explains that they rebuilt the set in CG to make sure that the takes that were shot from slightly different angles actually looked like they were one seamless take. And that is non-trivial visual effects work. That is on par with the most complicated stuff that anyone would be doing. And even if you just assumed, like, okay, this is the conceit of this movie is that it takes place in one take, and yeah, that's going to be slightly more difficult than we would assume, just because things always get out of hand when you're shooting a movie, and it's always, you know, it's a war zone, and what you come out of it with is what you come out of it with, and then you have to assemble that as best you can. But the work in this movie is not, it's not a lesser tier of work than anything that either was in the Bake Off or that anyone else has been doing. It's all really impressive work, as noted by the fact that people buy that this is all one seamless take. I mean, I look at it and I just watched it again right before we did the show. And I'm watching it and I go, okay, either that's a seam between takes or that's a place they could do a seam. There are places where I can't tell if it's a seam or if it's just a place that would be good for a seam. Based on this article where they said there are over 100 stitches of different takes, I'm going to say anywhere that looked like a seam could be there to me probably was a seam, especially based on the fact that they're mixing multiple performances, which is absurd. And it's just there's so much work in this that, you know, award season is award season, and we're not going to talk about fair when it comes to rewarding the work. But what we can talk about is how it is unjust that they were told to not speak about what kind of work they were doing until after awards season, which it seems shady. Whether or not they were actually honestly trying to maintain an illusion for I don't know what audience, because you know, the movie-going audience, we could tell them it's all visual effects, and for them, all that means is somebody clicked some buttons in the computer. But for filmmakers who should be intelligent enough, and people in the Academy who should be intelligent enough to know the extent of what is capable, hiding what actually was done is, it seems deceitful to me. And I think you feel the same way.
Yeah, well, I completely agree. It's deceitful. And, you know, while you're saying the general public, you know, doesn't really like to think about VFX stuff, and they don't know what it is, and it's all computers, you know, you like push a button and then all of a sudden it just happens. That is oftentimes how the directors and the actors can feel about visual effects. We've seen many times in the news that, like, with performance capture stuff, people get very touchy and very sensitive about how much of that is their performance and how much of that was modified by somebody going back in and redoing animation of what they were actually doing during their performance.
This is the argument as to why Andy Serkis is not ever nominated for a Best Actor.
Yes. And even he campaigns for it, bless his soul. But it's one of those things where they can't compartmentalize the fact that this they can't find any one person that they want to award, and they can't see their way to thinking about the people that contribute to the performance of a character or to the look of a set piece or something like that. They can only perceive like one person's vision being executed, which is a huge flaw in the award season. So I think it's very intentional to not discuss the fact that many people helped the cinematographer actually pull this off. Because while Emmanuel did tons of planning, they set up like a fake stage of what it was going to be like when they went to go shoot in New York. They taped out different areas. They planned shots. They needed to know the exact angles to shoot things for the mirror takes and stuff like that. Like, they... It's not that he didn't do work, and I want to stress that. It is, what he did is a lot of work, but the fact that it wasn't just him is what I want to get across, and that giving the award only to him and to have no thanks given to the VFX people that worked on it is what I'm pushing against here, and I believe also what you're objecting to. Like, neither one of us thinks that Emmanuel didn't do it, just sat on his butt and then VFX stepped in and did it all for him. That's not what either one of us is saying, but it is definitely the thing where, like, the Academy doesn't want to recognize that multiple people helped pull something off. It is a person that did it. And I think that is a huge flaw in the system. And you know, and it's one of those things where it's like, I don't care if they didn't win the award. Like, if Birdman didn't actually win the VFX award or didn't actually win cinematography or something like that, but when people talk about your movie, it is important, like, for you to receive that recognition. And if for something to be nominated, while it's a cliche to say, like, oh, well, it's an honor to be nominated, it is actually in a way an honor to be nominated, because whatever is on that list is going to get viewed by tons of people. And so to make sure that you suppress as much as possible the fact that other people helped out is pretty sad. And Emmanuel also worked, was the cinematographer for Gravity, a film which is almost entirely CG. And he won the cinematography award for that. And not just cinematography from the American Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, but also the BAFTAs, as well as the ASC awards. I mean, he wins a lot of awards for the cinematography that he does. And like I shared with you when I sent you the acceptance speeches for this stuff, strangely, he doesn't ever go to the BAFTAs, but he sends people to read his speeches, which always sounded almost exactly the same. But he thanks the cast and crew, and then he thanks the director profusely and the actress profusely, and says thanks to the Academy and what an honor it was. And in the only difference is in the Gravity Awards, he thanked Framestore, the visual effects house that worked on Gravity. But he thanked them as the Framestore nerds. And he did that twice, in the Academy Awards acceptance speech and in his BAFTA acceptance speech. So it wasn't an accident. And while it might be a cute, charming way to describe other people, like, oh, isn't that funny? Like, you know, people using computers, LOL, nerds. I think it really belittles, in a way, their contribution. That they're like, you know, like little elves, like cobbling together shoes when no one's looking at night. Like, they're contributing to the process in a very sophisticated way, and literally the movie Gravity wouldn't exist without them, and the movie Birdman wouldn't exist without Rodeo's work. There was that one IndieWire thing that I sent you where it's like they're describing the number of intricate wipes they did at Technicolor when they were doing the color timing and stuff, and it's like, well,
yeah.
You didn't do this movie with wipes. There's literally no way that you would have done this movie with wipes. And for the listeners who might not be as familiar, a wipe is basically like in Star Wars, when it just goes from one side of the screen to the other. At no point in this movie does it just wipe from one side of the screen to the other, seamlessly transitioning from one handheld camera shot to another moving handheld camera shot.
Actually, I think there is precisely one of them where it ducks into his dressing room after he has the underwear scene, and he goes to the refrigerator to eat the cold cuts. But yeah, there is no way. I mean, again, this is maybe what I'm getting back to when I say they're using dumbed down terminology for the general public who's watching this. But the overall thing is, okay, you can call... We shouldn't even really dive into this whole calling visual effects artists nerds thing, because it's offensive if you dive even just like a half an inch underneath the surface of it. Like, are we bigger nerds than the guys who run around on set with like belts full of little equipment that are, you know, intricately cleaning and adjusting film cameras and have little colored filters and little doohickeys that tell them the brightness of the light and what color of light is? Like, no, everyone on a film set is a nerd. You have to be a nerd in your little world. That's what you do. It's because of the fact that it's on computers that people refer to us as nerds. But the thing about it is, when he goes on to thank his Steadicam crew or his camera assistants, you know, he's acknowledging that, you know, he needs help on set. He's not literally running the camera himself. He's not literally moving all of the lights himself. He's got a team of people and he's got tools that he uses. Like, even on IMDb, there's a category for what camera you used, what types of lenses you used, what type of dollies you used. You know, all that information is accessible. But why then are we ignoring the fact that we are using a software application as a tool? And yet, you know, there are other people that are part of that crew that are working on it. And that's, you know, the visual effects team should be considered part of his camera crew. And maybe it's just that the perception of having 90 people who would be fit into the quote camera crew makes it look like his contribution. I mean, even if he's the leader of that group, it seems like he's doing less himself. I don't know. I don't know where that perception comes from, because we're all on the same team here. And the only thing I can think is that the Academy is still in their antiquated ways, you know, and the award show has more or less not changed significantly since it was created, in that we're awarding a single person for their role. But there's no way any of these movies these days are made without intense collaboration. Maybe the awards are just not sophisticated enough to try and figure out how to reward people appropriately, but it seems like they could do more than literally nothing. And it seems like they could do more because, you know, there is a lot of political nonsense that goes into how somebody is qualified to receive an award. And maybe they felt by admitting that all of this work was done in visual effects that they would be out of the running for the cinematography award, and they didn't want that. And that's why they buried it. But it doesn't make any sense. Like, we shouldn't cover up what the actual truth of the matter was just because we want to fit into some antiquated award ceremony, because we want to feel like we can stand up on stage and say, you know, look what we did. Because, you know, these films are an intense collaboration. There is literally no way any of these movies, Birdman specifically, could even exist without a ton of post-production work. I can't figure out why they would not do this.
Yeah, well, I mean, I can just show you an example. Not too long ago, was it 3 years ago? 2013, two years ago, the cinematography Oscar for A Life of Pi, there was a huge backlash because Life of Pi was not something that was done in a camera lens. It just wasn't. It was CG. There were elements that were photographed and filmed on a set, on a soundstage, but the vast majority of what you saw that would take up your frame was simply not there for the cinematographer to weigh in on. And so that is left entirely to the domain, in this case, of Rhythm and Hughes and the visual effects supervisor on the film. And after they won the cinematography Oscar, in which the cinematographer, Claudia Miranda, did not thank visual effects or Rhythm and Hughes. Arguably, maybe it didn't occur to him at the time, but I think it should have. It very well ought to have. But afterwards, there were a lot of articles that were published. I'm looking at one right now. It says, Cinematography Oscar for Life of Pi an Insult, says Christopher Doyle. He's another cinematographer in the same field as Claudia Miranda, and he's criticizing him for winning for something that is not in his control, that is not his domain. I'm not going to read exactly what he says, because he goes on to rant and rave in some colorful language, and we'd have to do a lot of bleeping, but I'll put it in the thing and for the show notes and stuff. It's one of those things where, you know, arguably they're scared of they're scared of not acknowledging that cinematographer was authoritative in what he did, and that he has the authorship and deserves the award, and that the visual effects did not have authorship and does not deserve the award and did not influence the final product in any meaningful way that could detract from the cinematographer. It just really bothers me. They have a hard enough time where they, you know, have a couple seconds of time to show the VFX award. Like this year, I don't watch it because I just get so angry watching the stupid award show. But this year, I've been told that they didn't screen any of the footage from the visual effects shots that were for the movies that were up for the VFX Oscar. The best visual effects of the year, and they didn't show clips of visual effects. It's just so strange to me to hear that news. But in a way, it makes sense, I guess. Is the award went to Interstellar. Like I said, you know, Paul Franklin, and I think the work in Interstellar is very good. And like we talked about when we did our Interstellar episode, they did good work in what they were doing, except for like I objected to some of the robot cartwheel stuff. But they were up against a lot of other films, and it wasn't entirely clear who would come out with the win here. And it wound up being a film that has no digital characters at all, very minimal set pieces, and uses miniatures, very well publicized for using miniatures. It makes me wonder whether or not it was selected because they wanted to give Christopher Nolan an award for something, but didn't want to give him Best Picture or Screenplay or any of that stuff. And so they selected this as a mass group of the Academy Awards, because sometimes they'll like sort of like give you a weird consolation Oscar in some other category if you don't win. Like sometimes somebody will get Best Director and not Best Picture and vice versa. It's one of those. It's so strange that it's relegated to such a teeny tiny little spot, and even then, it's like, well, as long as you didn't do a whole lot of stuff that we can object to, then maybe we'll consider you. Like Rocket Raccoon, Groot, digital characters in films, like just a blip, nothing. It's so strange. I can only assume that it is some sort of reactionary stance against the proliferation of these very visual effects heavy films, which don't get put up for any of the Best Picture of the Year awards, but do tremendous box office business, and they're what's keeping the studios functioning. The box office returns on these films is what greases all the wheels right now. So it's so frustrating and so weird.
It's an interesting theory. Do you, because normally, you know, there's that joke that the thing that wins for best visual effects is should be named most visual effects. And in this instance, I don't think Interstellar would really qualify as most visual effects, especially against like something like Guardians. But it would be interesting if this is some sort of backlash against those kinds of movies, because that would mean that they're kind of sweeping it under the rug as like the dirty little secret that, yeah, these big movies are the ones that are literally keeping the lights on in all of the studios, but we're just going to pretend they don't exist because we don't like them. Or maybe it's just around awards time, but you know, we may just be getting into mudslinging territory with this. But the one other thing that, you know, is worth mentioning when we talk about, you know, Life of Pi or any of these movies, is that it is ostensibly the DP's job to watch what everyone is doing, and he should be weighing in on the work that the post houses are doing. But once it gets into something where, you know, like Gravity or like Life of Pi, where everything, you know, 99% of the frame is CG, and in some cases 100% of it is CG, while he may weigh in on, you know, the look or what he wanted in terms of his lighting, he is a much smaller piece of the puzzle than really he would be on set, because on set, he's kind of number two to the director in terms of the ability to have an impact on what's actually showing up on film. But It's not to say really that the DP is just gone once the cameras are no longer rolling, but he has a much smaller role, and it is still technically his job as the DP, and he could still technically reap the benefits and the awards for, you know, cinematography work done in post. But it does beg, you know, can we come up with any more sophisticated system than just rewarding one guy for an entire team's worth of work? It seems a little silly at that point.
Well, there's a couple things. It's the auteur theory, first of all, where you want to heap as much praise on as gifted of an individual as you possibly can. And that when people think crews and casting crews and et cetera, it's not as heartfelt, I want to say, in many instances. But I've never, in all of the years that I've worked on visual effects, I've never had a note from the TP. Never. Not once on anything.
Is that because it wouldn't get through the supervisor down to you, or do you just think the supervisor is making those calls?
Oh, no. I literally know who's making notes. I don't get one from him. He's not involved at that point in the production. You get notes from the director. You get notes from producers. You get notes from studios. You get notes from all kinds of people. You don't get DP notes. Now, I'm not going to speak on behalf of what happened on Birdman or what happened on Gravity or what happened on Life of Pi, because I didn't work on any of those movies. They might very well have had a lot of input from the director of photography. No one discusses it, so I'm going to assume that's not actually the case. But the situation, for the most part, is that you get the footage that director of photography shot, and then you put in the visual effects, and then it goes back to the director. He approves it. It goes into the movie, into the edit, and everything. And the DP will come back in and maybe sit in the he'll sit with the colorist, and they'll go through the DI stuff. But he's not going to like change the framing of an all CG digital shot at that point. He doesn't sit there and do that. Now, I'm sure there are plenty of exceptions to this rule, and notably Zemeckis movies, where he wanted to like make a whole system of trying to direct it like it was an actual on-set performance, etc., with cameras that were sort of like mo-capped cameras. By and large, you mostly just get like a lump of film from editorial that's been picked through for the performances that they want. And they'll say like, oh, well, we like this performance from this take and this one from this take, or we like this, but we want to flop it, meaning they flop the frame, which is not really what the DP intended to do on set most of the time. And they'll be like, okay, well, we like it, but it feels too static, so we're going to add a push in. Oh, well, we like it, but we want to reframe the shot. It's too far out. We like it, but we want to retime this. Retimes are not really something you do on set.
Unless you're Wes Anderson.
And so, you know, it's one of those things where it's like you can say that the DP has a tremendous amount of input at many stages of the process. But to say that VFX stuff is like some sort of like DP heavy process is not the case.
No, and I wouldn't say DP heavy process. I would say he has the potential to be the guy making decisions when it comes to lighting. And maybe it's interesting to hear that you've never gotten a DP note, but it's probably not surprising. I would be curious to get a little bit more feedback on things like Gravity, where it is almost entirely CG. But, you know, at some point, somebody's going to have to do the look development, and maybe that is just presented to the director. But it is true that it's going to come back to him in color correction afterwards. But I would think, since he is in that role, he would want some sort of input in the visual effects process. I just don't know. I don't know. Maybe it's just that. I'm just entirely speculating now. It is interesting that he is not in that process, at least from your perspective. But I'd be curious, when everything is CG, at what point does he come back in, or does he just wait till DI again?
Oh, are you speaking specifically of Emmanuel or Claudia?
I'm speaking specifically about Emmanuel, because we're talking about Gravity, but
yeah,
you know, again, they did a lot of stuff with that was lit before they even shot it, especially when, you know, they built those light box sets where they're trying to get realistic lighting, which was of course augmented with in visual effects, but they could potentially just use that planning as their baseline, because they didn't even really do a whole lot of complex lighting while they were shooting. It was all kind of generated by those light panels.
Yeah, well, that's because people,
we're gonna need to make this three episodes.
We need to talk about Gravity, because there is a misconception that Sandra Bullock and George Clooney were in suits on a set that was lit, and that there was like a green screen behind them or something. They were digital all the time. Now,
except for just that little slit through the mask.
Yeah, the part that's their face, that part, they kept from the performance on the set. And this is very true. You can go find behind the scenes set photography of what it looked like. They were in these boxy suits that had tracking markers on them and that resembled the volume of what the CG suit would be. So that way you don't have an actor like sticking their hand in their torso or something. But they weren't even really the suits as they would appear later. It wasn't a situation where it was augmented like a color correction or something, or, you know, like, oh, well, it was just, you know, like gain up the highs or something. Like that didn't happen. There was no suit. It was all digitally done. They used a heavily modified version of commercial Arnold, and used that to do all their ray trace rendering of all this beautiful stuff. To say that those were just the Framestore nerds, I think belittles the amount of contribution to the fact that there wouldn't be anything in the movie without them.
Especially considering they were in the set building process, like the technology that was used to physically light the faces came from the post people. It's that whole thing is a mess. But we should wrap up this discussion about visual effects and actually talk about the movie for a little bit, because I think we have a few things to say. Suffice it to say, we are not super thrilled that the post-production team, who did incredible, extensive, very well-done work on Birdman, was not, to our opinion, appropriately thanked and appreciated. And we would like to say good work on from our perspectives, and we hope this sort of thing changes in the future.
Yeah, and
is that about sum it up?
Yeah, and that if you are someone who's running a studio and you're listening to this podcast, shame on you. Shame on you for telling these people they can't talk about it during award season, jerk face. That meaning that I don't think anyone is actually listening to this part. so it's pretty safe to say that, because Lord knows I wouldn't actually say that to the president of Fox Searchlight or any of that stuff. So moving on, like you said.
And then just to insert one more thing in there that we're not going to talk about, is the reason we can't say those things to the studios is because we desperately need them to hire us and we have no leverage. But we'll come back to that at another time. So Birdman, you know, just as a transition piece, let's talk about preference. When I heard initially about this movie, I think we talked about it. I don't know if we talked about it on an episode or we talked about it offline. I had heard that this was a well-made movie, but I had also heard that they did this sort of, it's supposed to be a single one shot. And if you recall, my initial reaction was eye rolls and groans, because that is a terrible idea and I hate it without even seeing it.
I recall that.
And it's interesting because there are a number of stories that came out in the press of other DPs or directors giving advice to Mr. Inarritu that it should not be done that way, because that's A, really difficult, and B, kind of like a cliche thing to do, and you probably shouldn't do that. And he went with it anyway, and I think he added something to it, so it kind of isn't just a single take, you know, obviously with the augmentation with, you know, the CG work, like in the street with the giant CG bird and all that fun stuff. He did more to it than just make it a single take. But I don't know. I still, to this day, just watching it again, I'm still not sure why this needs to be a long take. I like the close-up Steadicam work. Well, I should say the medium Steadicam work, because there are a few instances where the cameras get way too close to people, in my opinion. And again, this whole category is my opinion. I like the Steadicam work in that it is capable of kind of you know, Steadicam and handheld stuff gives you the feeling that you're kind of a person in the scene, and it helps us get close to the people and helps with the sort of intimacy of the sort of mental struggle, I think, at times. But I do still think that it was kind of unnecessary to make it one single shot. And I think it was probably just once they got into this rhythm of saying, okay, these long scenes are going to be all one contiguous take, they kind of just went like, why not make it all one thing? I don't know. I kind of got the feeling that it was kind of like it was going to be a bunch of long takes just to get from place to place. And they just kind of said, yeah, we can, with a little bit more added work, just make it all one take. So why not?
Okay. Let me unpack a couple things there. Yes, I very much remember the conversation we initially had about it, where you were telling me that it was one long take and that you were horrified. And you thought it would never work, and you thought it was terrible, and you thought it was a horrible gimmick. And I said, well, I don't really know. Let's wait and see how it goes. I mean, how are they going to do the passage of time? That doesn't make any sense.
Oh, how the tables have turned in this discussion.
I know, I know. And like you said, a reminder, this is a discussion of preference. Like we said, the work that was done that actually pulled this off, technically, is very good. It makes the whole thing function as a piece. And you should marvel at the fact that it was all seamed together from bits and pieces of these 10-minute, 20-minute long performances of these very talented people, and not just the people that you see on the screen, but the people who have to run around behind the camera on the screen to make things happen, make props line up where they're supposed to be. Like,
if nothing else, this movie should be appreciated in the sense that it's a lot like this podcast we do, where we snip out like hundreds of little things that no one will ever know weren't there and stitch it all together to keep the pace moving the way we want and the flow moving the way we want, and remove the little bits that didn't work or the stops and starts. And nobody has any knowledge of that. But, you know, they use those sorts of techniques in the movie, this giant Hollywood movie, to make a seamless and paced the way they want film. And just the technique required just to do that is astounding. But then on top of that, there's all this other work that increased the effect of it.
I'm not sure about that metaphor, but I'll let the listeners weigh in on that. But the because I get what you're saying. Where you're saying it's the illusion of one continuous conversation, even though every now and then, you know, like you'll hit a mic stand, or I'll like slurp loudly on a drink or something.
Yeah, it is used for pacing as well as just visual effects of stitching things together. And that's all I'm really saying. It's used for more than just the visual gag, and it's used for the timing of things, which I think is an appropriate use of it. But I'm still not sold on whether or not it needs to be one take.
I'm not sold either. The whole entire time I was watching it, I was thinking to myself, why did this need this? And I've read afterwards from the director and from the cinematographer recounting the conversations he had with the director, because apparently Emmanuel was not initially on board with this either. But the director insisted that it needed to be a single take because it was important to it feeling like it was this play. I disagree. There have been movies about plays that didn't need a single take, and so I don't think that that really rings true for me. I think there is a fascination with the fetish with actually pulling it off, to be able to say that you achieved this thing. And I think largely,
which they didn't.
Largely, I think that is why he got the cinematography award. And I think that is largely why a lot of people have talked about the movie in general. Like, if this was a performance that was broken up and paced by editing instead of through this process, and keep in mind, there were editors that worked on this, and they did put all the pieces together in order for this to flow together. There weren't always actors on screen. There was dead air and stuff that they filled with, you know, slow camera pans and like the changing of the skyline, the you know, color of the sky, basically, because it was like a day for night color correction kind of thing, which I want to talk to you about. If you really, really, really felt this needed to be all one take, why did you just shift the camera up to the sky and just do a pseudo time lapse of everything changing and then shift the camera back down again. I mean, and he does it twice in the film. I don't understand. I mean, he might as well have just like done a time lapse of a clock. Like that would have been just as cliched as like a time lapse of you know, the sun changing or something like that, or maybe like a shadow on the wall changing. I mean, these are all cliches in editing where we know that that is supposed to signal the passage of time. So I don't know why you get to go off the hook when you just leave that in there as part of your single take instead of, you know, like cutting away to that. Like if you would cut away to that in a movie, people would be like, ugh, really? You know, because you don't need really that shorthand of time passing. Like unless you're really intent on keeping everything in the frame the whole entire time, I don't know if it was I thought it was distracting.
There's actually three of them. There's two of the ones where we're up at the sky and it goes from night to day again. But then right before the last bit of the theater, it goes from day to night, and they fast forward time there as well. And it is interesting. I think this is another instance where it was like, you know, there are a lot of things at play. You know, getting back to the one take thing, I've heard a few other people talk about how this expectation that the audience has, you know, watching movies, you know, just as the movie going public, they're waiting for a cut to release the tension of these tense scenes. And the fact that the cut never comes sort of amplifies and continues that tension forward throughout the movie. And I can see that as a point, and maybe there is some of that when you're talking about some of these longer takes, but I think there's so much done with the pacing moving up and down, especially with the music cues, that's not really what it's being used for. And when it comes to the stuff like the sky, I'm confused because towards the end of the movie, we get the reveal kind of that Riggan has like basically not slept for like 3 days when they're doing all of these previews and stuff. So up until the part where he gets drunk and passes out on the stairs. So potentially he is awake doing things when this camera is fast forwarding through time, and maybe it's just not relevant to what we need. And, you know, this is maybe just another instance where the visual effects are being used to pace the movie or increase speed in certain areas, but it's just increasing them very rapidly. But, you know, it is it's the kind of cop-out you would see in a movie that just wants to, you know, it's like a mimic of the effect we get in Scott Pilgrim where Wallace passes out on the bed and then there's the cut to it's daylight and he's laying in the exact same position. Like, that was a funny staged version there, and, you know, I think they only did it once, maybe twice in that movie, but like, I'm not sure why that was the way they chose to go. Just the tilt up to the sky and we're just going to skip a day now. Obviously they need to get through 3 days worth of material in this movie, in which case, again, I come back to, why did this need to be a single take? Like, would it have been that much different if there would have been an actual fade to black there and then we fade up in the next scene? Like, do we really need to pick up the camera from where it left off? I don't know. Maybe the reason is we're supposed to be, since everything, again, is handheld or Steadicam, we're supposed to be a person running around in the back of this theater and we're going to sleep and we're waking up in the same position and then going about our business, although I don't know why we'd be sleeping on the roof. Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure about that. Those moments seem less thought out than the rest of the movie to me, but maybe that's just because I can't think of a reason for them.
Yeah, I similarly can't think of a reason for them. And again, like we stipulated, this is preference. We're not saying there's anything technically like functionally incorrect. It is weird.
There is a little bit of parallax fudging.
Okay. Well, yes. But I'm saying, like, in our judgment, like, the reason why we're objecting strongly is it doesn't appeal to us, that which is different from like, oh, well, I don't know why they had to do that, but I agree with Dan. I don't see the reason that this needed to be one cut, because and you know, technically the movie isn't one cut. There are cuts at the end, but we're predominantly discussing the fact that like 90% of this movie, 96% or whatever of this movie has no cut visually in it. It is seamed together digitally by VFX artists, and it's supposed to give the illusion that it is all fluidly occurring. And like you said, it doesn't detract from the tension of it. Like, there's no release. Like, everything keeps going. I felt like it was sort of draining. Like, not in a positive way, where I feel like I just watched like a really depressing movie, but it was really important. Like, I feel just drained by the process of energy draining out of me as I sit there and watch the scenes unfold, with no break in it. Like, it didn't feel tense to me, which I know you said was, you know, arguably one of the reasons why people do long takes, is to make tension, you know, that you don't get to have that cut that moves you on. But it felt sort of just draining and tiring. And it very quickly wore on me, especially when we would have the meandering moments. I didn't find them novel or enchanting, where we would just like be looking at a wall or looking down a hallway and then nothing would be happening. And then we'd slowly push in. It's not the same. Like, I just really had wish that it is not saying that no one can do long cuts, or that a long cut of this specific length is incorrect, and that there's some optimal length of a long cut. I mean, well, there's probably a dirty joke I could make right now, but I'm not going to do it. It's one of those things where, just watching it, it just doesn't feel like it works for me. I don't feel involved in the way that I think the movie and the director want me to feel involved with the film, where I'm engaged 100% in what is occurring on the screen, and I can't turn away because there's nothing to turn away to. I feel like I very much can turn away, and that my attention does seem to wander. As I had documented when I was watching this and taking notes, there was a whole like 10-minute chunk where I had to like rewind because I just couldn't take it anymore, and I was just staring off into the distance. I don't even remember what part of the movie it was. It is so strange to me. And now, you know, a lot of people might judge me like that is, you know, a fault of my own, that I'm not able to appreciate this level of art, that I expect more common pedestrian things. But I don't necessarily think there is anything common or pedestrian about editing cuts. I don't think there's...
No, that gets into the whole argument, like, you just didn't get the film and it's your fault. Like, no, it's incumbent upon the filmmakers to make sure the audience understands it. And I do, to a certain extent, it's probably more of a mixed bag on my side, but I do agree with you. Like, there were moments where... And again, for me, tension is built in the framing and the performances, but not just the fact that it doesn't cut. Like, the scene with him and Emma Stone, where they're sort of yelling at each other across that bar.
I hate that scene.
I hate it too, but probably for a different reason. There's a moment when she's going on a very long rant, and not only is the camera framed very poorly, it is like cocked at an angle, so my head starts to physically tilt while I'm watching it. And I'm watching it, and my head is still tilting because the camera is still like floating in the wrong direction and it's off angle. And it's like, guys, like, I appreciate when you get close to the moments where we need to see the emotion in people's faces, but like, at what expense? Like, that particular scene got to me because it was just like, the framing, first of all, was just kind of off kilter and weird and pointing in a direction where like 70% of the frame was just like a blank wall. And we're kind of, it just felt like the camera guy was getting as close as he possibly could to Michael Keaton without like jumping in the way. It just felt like there was a cameraman physically standing there and getting tired. And it didn't work the way some of the other scenes worked, where it sort of flowed from place to place for me. Why do you hate that scene?
Okay. I'm going to break it down for a lot of the same reasons that you did. The framing is weird. And also because I can feel the place where the camera is in 3D space. This is one of those big things that I object to in almost any film. If I am aware of what the camera is doing rather than what I am seeing, then I don't really feel involved in the moment. And I'm very much aware of what the camera is doing. It is between Keaton and Emma Stone, and it is panning back and forth tracking back and forth between the two of them, you can feel the camera operator turning his body. He twists from one direction to the other direction, and they wait to talk and respond at weird intervals because it has to rely on when the camera's on them. There's no cutting, so you're not like cutting back and forth between two people arguing like we're used to, where you'd have like reverse shot of Emma Stone and Keaton arguing. In this case, you're actually literally turning the camera from one person to the other, and the other person's kind of respectfully waiting until they're framed in the camera to talk. And it is very strange. It is like a slow motion weird ping pong argument. I'm sorry, table tennis argument. It is very unusual. Now, I have other objections to the scene, but they go into the screenplay, which we haven't delved into yet. So I don't want to move us too far along that road unless you think we're prepared to delve into the screenplay, which also won an Oscar. Shockingly.
Yeah, let's talk about the screenplay for a minute. Let's talk about sort of an overview of what this movie is actually about. It's about our character Regan Thompson, played by Michael Keaton, who is a very old man who was in some superhero movies long, long ago and has had apparently minimal success in parlaying that into a career post-gigantic blockbuster movie, and is now seeking to do a play on Broadway adapted from a Raymond Carver novel, which we later find out is because Raymond Carver is the reason he became an actor. But he is struggling to get his cast and crew to work together to create this piece of work that is, in his mind, artistically relevant and legitimate, whereas the Birdman stuff is the past. And while it was a large success, it did not have any artistic integrity, and it was more of a... There are a few lines that make us believe that he, after the first one, was sucked into this system and was unhappy about it, but continued to make these movies until he was miserable and eventually said no to the fourth one, and has struggled to find himself within his career afterwards. And he's really hoping that this is the thing that will put him back on the map as not only an actor in the public eye, but as an actor that people respect and give credence to in terms of somebody that actually has talent. And then there are antics that ensue that sort of stop him along the way. Is that about sum it up?
Yeah, the general sense. I was going to say that the screenwriting here, just to reinforce the fact, this won an award. So my objection to this. It is obviously an award-winning movie. So no one write in to tell me that I am wrong because it won an award, because that is not how it works with feelings. I can have my feelings. So my feelings on this are that this movie tries very hard to tell us how important this movie is by giving these characters very pedestrian things to say to one another, where they tell each other how they feel, they tell each other what they are doing or will do. It's very deliberate whenever they communicate to one another. Like, they'll say like, oh, well, I'm going to ruin your movie. It's like, okay, well, that how is that brilliant screenwriting? Like, you literally just said what you're going to do. Like, it should be like, this is a performance of like, oh, well, I'm saying this one thing and this sleight of hand, I'm doing this other thing. And all this, there's no cleverness here. The cleverness is all on the surface. It is very shallow, in my opinion. You know, and like I said, with the critic feeling shallow, as I guess the mustache twirling villain of like, I will destroy you and put you out of business and ruin your career, ha ha ha. Like that, I find absurd. But the argument he has with his daughter is also equally absurd, in that it is over all of the things that, if you were to make a list, like, what are things that old men would say to their younger daughters about their feelings and their careers? List accomplished, all on the part of Michael Keaton. What are the things that a young daughter would say back to their older parent? List accomplished. There is nothing surprising or unexpected or spontaneous feeling in their conversation. like they you know, he criticizes her, like, oh, you and your friends and your YouTube and your Snapchats and your Vimeos and whatever, like he your social experience on the internet and all this stuff. He criticizes in the old manniest old man way he could criticize. It is like you asked a teenager to write an argument that they feel an old man would have. That does not feel sophisticated to me. Likewise, Emma Stone's responses to him about how he's not on Twitter and how he's not on Facebook and he's not putting himself out there, it's just so incredibly ludicrous to me. Especially when you compare it to something like a simpler movie in a lot of ways, is Chef, which I feel like shares so many of the same themes as this film. And basically received no award recognition, so that's whatever. But there are similar themes there of like a kid that's been ignored and hasn't been appreciated. And the kid doesn't say, oh, I've been ignored and I haven't been appreciated. They show us in the film that the kid is ignored and hasn't been appreciated. We don't get the whole like, oh, well, I don't understand social media. Like, doesn't say that. They show that he doesn't understand social media. They show the kid explaining it to him. Like, that literally happens in that film. It's the same stuff. It is one of those things where you can see them building a world that they're shooting on film rather than building a world on the page that they're saying to one another. And I can't object strongly enough to two actors yelling back and forth at one another exactly how they feel. It is so strange. It is not something that I feel really pushes this medium forward. So, you know, sure, it won the Oscar. It really did. Honest to God, it won it. Like, that is factually accurate. But I don't feel like this movie connects to me on any emotional level at all. It doesn't have the sophistication that I look for in a film. It doesn't even seem to have the sophistication of a Jon Favreau movie, which is basically about the same stuff. So it is mind-boggling, the kind of writing that is in this film. But anyway, I think I ranted long enough.
I wanted to let you go because this is the part where our discussion is going to start to diverge, because while I understand there are things I disagree with, because for me, and I think for other people to different degrees, and this is, again, super subjective, and once you start talking about this kind of stuff, you get into the whole things you can and can't prove or things that are empirical evidence or not. For me, there is another level to this movie wherein the things that we see on the surface are potentially referencing other things, or they're not actually there. So there is this level of hallucination and delusion to the movie. And I think that is, it's played very straight, and there are instances where it's more clear than other times. But I think a lot of the dialogue is often on the nose, especially when we're talking about social media and stuff. But I think there is some subtext to it where, in that scene in particular, yes, he's talking about how this is an important thing to him. And it's, you know, he's got a chance to do something real. And Emma Stone is basically saying, you don't even know what real is. Like, you're trying to have your version of artistic success, but you're so disconnected from the world that you don't even know what that actually means. You're saying it out loud, but you don't know what that means. And until you figure that out, you're not going to be able to have any level of success. And that's kind of, I mean, they do it. They go back and forth a couple different times. Keaton and Birdman are the ones who have this discussion a couple different times about, you know, what real success is, and his delusional voice in his head that is also manifested by a man in a suit walking around behind him is saying, like, you're bigger than all these people. Real success brings in tons of money. Everyone loves you. And he's saying, that's not what real success means. I want to have artistic integrity. I want to do something that has actual meaning, that's lasting. And the other part of his brain is saying, that's all bullshit. And he's the one saying, no, that's all bullshit. He's arguing with himself back and forth. And to a certain extent, a lot of what happens in this movie is metaphor for that same sort of thing. You know, the scene at the end of his play that we see a couple different times, where he's pointing the gun at Ed Norton and he says, you know, I'm not even here. You know, I've been spending every day trying to be something that I'm not, and I don't even know what I am anymore, and I'm not actually here, and then he shoots himself. That scene is, again, sort of a thinly veiled metaphor for this entire film, where he's struggling to figure out, A, what he wants, B, how to actually achieve that, and C, you know, if we actually agree with the end of the movie, he does achieve it, but is that actually what he wanted the whole time? So there is another level below the writing that I think is interesting to interpret while watching the movie. And, you know, it all comes back to the, you know, the Raymond Carver stuff, because he says that Raymond Carver is the reason he got into filmmaking, you know, being an actor in the first place. And that's why he decides to go back to his roots to try and figure out, you know, how he can be the actor that he was. He was led astray once he got some modicum of success with this Birdman movie, which by all intents is supposed to be Batman, which was really kind of the first of the breakout superhero movies. So it's safe to say that that kind of ran away with his career and his mind, and he just kind of got lost. And now he's trying to rediscover what he was, and he is struggling with it for a great many reasons. He is losing his mind, and he is not really handling it well. And, you know, that line right up front that his wife, you know, he has that scene with his wife where she basically says, "Now I remember why I broke up with you." You know, she has that line that, you know, you always confuse love for admiration. This guy is clearly struggling with the separation between his personality and his work. Like he does not see that they can be mutually exclusive. And that's one thing Michael Keaton's talked about in interviews is how he's never played a character that he relates to less because this guy is so needy and is trying to associate his identity so much with his work, and he's not actually like that in real life. But there are a great many people who are like this. And, you know, when you're a performer, it's easy to sort of see how those lines could be blurred, where you could potentially think that, yes, this perception in the public eye grows large enough that that becomes who you actually are, and you kind of lose yourself. And that's kind of what happens when people flame out dramatically in Hollywood, and he's kind of headed down that path, and the people who can stay grounded are the ones who have success. But, you know, and even when he's talking to Ed Norton shortly after that, he's saying, you know, this is me, I'm laying it out there. And, you know, Ed Norton just kind of says, like, these people don't know anything about you. Like, you know, all these people coming up to you want an autograph from Birdman, they don't know you. That's not you. They just know you, your stupid bird suit. Like, that's not you. Like, the theater is here where you're supposed to lay your heart out on the line, and this is where you be real. And he's got his, you know, his massive subplot, Ed Norton, about how,
okay, wait,
he's 100% real on stage and that the rest of the world is fake.
Before you recount everything in the movie,
yes,
I have some objections to things that you had
said
previously.
Please, jump in.
I didn't want to interrupt you because you were on a roll, but
It's all the same sort of theme, and I'll come back to it over and over again, so jump in as necessary.
Yeah, okay, so this is that thing, like when you're saying he's talking to his wife, and the wife says, you confuse, you know, admiration, that is on the nose. That bothers me. Like, it doesn't pull at my heartstrings. Like I was saying, you know, even Chef, like, I wasn't in tears with Chef, but at least I felt something, like, that this was a movie about, like, a tortured soul who, like, used to be somebody who was daring and had lost his way and was kind of in a sad, very stable place, and that he's doing something risky to go out on his own. And this movie shares a lot of those same themes. And, you know, it's not one of those things where, like, she says that and it, like, flips it's like reading a 1950s play, like, where they're just, like, up on stage and they're like, oh, I don't even know you anymore. Oh, this is so sad. I'm so sad. We're all sad. It's just, it bothers me. Like,
No, that's fair. That's fair. Yeah. I should say that I do agree with you in the sense that there isn't a point in this movie where I really, like, feel empathy for Michael Keaton's character. It's not the kind of movie that really draws me in and, like, breaks my heart. I do see, I do have the ability to go, I see what's happening to this guy and he's losing it, and that's unfortunate, but there's not much that can be done. Like, all of these things that are really on the nose, they're trying to rescue him from himself. And you can see there are a couple moments where there's, like, a glimmer in his eye where he goes, like, oh, like when Emma Stone does the little toilet paper thing that she gets from AA or whatever, you can see he starts to, like, break out of his delusion for a moment, but then he's just right back in the delusion, and you go, all right, we're essentially watching this guy just circle the drain, is basically the way this movie goes. But that is worth pointing out, that it doesn't really suck me in on an emotional level. On an intellectual level, I go, I see what this guy is going through, and that's really, it's kind of shitty, but like, it's not heartbreaking to me. Does that bring me back a little closer to your discussion?
Yeah, no, I'm curious though, like you said intellectually it appeals to you, this discussion that they're having on the screen. From my rage tweets, it didn't strike the same notes with me. So I'd like to actually hear, like, when you say intellectually appealing, because we've discussed, like, the dialogue is on the nose. We've discussed, like, the situations are very staged, set up around this gossamer thin metaphor for his situation in the film. Like, intellectually, what is the part that speaks to you the most, where you go, oh, that's actually like a very clever way that the director has put this together, has arranged this, or is it, you know, the play within the movie is the intelligent part, or is it the ending of the film that is the intelligent part? Is it the not knowing what is real and what isn't real that is the intelligent part? Like, what is it that speaks to you, like you're saying, intellectually about it, where it's something that you would go, oh wow, that's really the best picture. Like, I can't think of something else that made me, you know, really scratch my head, like, and consider life as much as this film.
Well, the thing about this that I like thinking about is, you know, it's kind of the thing that's at the heart of this is the difference between Michael Keaton and Ed Norton. Ed Norton is, for all intents and purposes, a great actor, but he is a 180-degree different human being on the stage and off the stage. On the stage, he is great. He is honest. You know, he has his line about, you know, out there, you don't pretend. That's what's real, and that's how you give a great performance. And off the stage, he is kind of a slimy, annoying little jerk. And the problem is Michael Keaton hasn't been able to separate those two things in his mind. So he wants to be like Ed Norton on the stage, but he's taking that off the stage with him, and it is ruining his life and his sanity. And the reason I find it particularly interesting, and this is again me, is I have in the past, and, you know, probably continue to this day, to struggle to separate myself from my work. And, you know, like, I have legitimately had a panic attack waiting to hear someone's feedback on a script I wrote, which is idiotic. Like, it's just work. This is what we do. You know, it's not necessarily a reflection of me as a human being, but the ability to take something too personally when it is really important work to you is something that I could potentially identify with. Certainly not in the level of Michael Keaton, but that's what I mean when I say I look at this guy and I see what he's going through, and it is unfortunate that he cannot see the way Ed Norton lives to separate his work from his personality. And I think that's why Ed Norton is successful in this play, and I think that's why he's a good actor. And Michael Keaton sees that, and, you know, it gets back to this whole on stage, you don't pretend, that's where you got to be honest. And once he finally does break, he literally shoots himself in order to be honest enough to be respected as an actor, which is idiotic, because he should be able to tell the difference between being an honest actor on stage and being an alive human being off stage. Like, where those two worlds meet as an artist or a performer or whatever, like, I'm not an actor, but I can sort of make that leap as somebody who, you know, works on set and works on movies or whatever. I can make that leap to understand where you could lose yourself, especially if you talk about people who are method actors who really try and embody a character, which for all intents and purposes Ed Norton is, by the fact that he tries to have sex with Naomi Watts on stage because it would be more realistic, because apparently he's a nut job.
Okay, but wait, you brought up something interesting with the whole thing of the suicide, which I would like to get back to later. As to whether or not it is a suicide or whether you survived, blah, 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 blah. In the meantime, I do want to unpack some of this Edward Norton stuff. There were some times when you were just talking right now, Fast and Furious, whether or not I was unsure if you were describing Edward Norton the actor, or if you were describing Edward Norton as the actor in the film, or Edward Norton as the actor in the film playing the character, or, you know, it is...
Yeah. Yeah. I'm talking about the character in the movie, sort of all-encompassing. But it is also that interesting mirror to real life, where apparently Ed Norton is an incredibly difficult actor to work with because he is super hands-on and always wants to make sure everything is 100% perfect and will, you know, take control of a movie. But I'm talking about him, his character in the film. I'm just not using character names because I'm lazy.
Yeah, no. I want to make that clear for the audience. And also, just to highlight, you know, I am not sure it's entirely coincidence that he was cast in this particular role,
right.
Because he's notoriously difficult. So that you cast him as someone who is notoriously difficult. And you know, I think he turns in a very brave performance here, being very candid about being a difficult person, I guess, in a way, by accepting this role.
I wonder how much of that was the director saying, like, you know, people say you're difficult, explain your side and go. And then just kind of let Ed Norton riff on top of that to sort of say, like, yeah, I'm difficult, but it's all for the purity of art or blah, 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 or whatever his actual reasons are. I've never heard him actually describe it in real life.
But nobody gets to riff in this movie. This is all on paper, because remember, they planned this out and they shot this. Now, maybe there was some line from rehearsal or something that got worked in, but this nothing you saw there was a spontaneous moment of riffing.
Right. I think I'm maybe imagining that scene between him and Michael Keaton where they're first workshopping the script may have actually happened in real life, where, you know, he knows the other people's words and he's kind of stopping them saying, like, let me direct you for a moment. What is that line's intention? Like, let's fix this up right now. Like, that's the part where I feel like he's kind of a dick in that scene, but he's doing it to the betterment of the script itself. Like, I don't know if any of that happened in pre-production for this movie, but I like to imagine that it did. Like, this whole thing is just metaphors all the way down, from production all the way down to post.
Yeah, okay. So, another thing. With Naomi Watts, I found, like I was saying, where I was describing earlier, the sort of the fact that the film feels like a play, like a very dated play, in which a lot of people are telling you how they feel about things. I thought that Naomi Watts was actually turning in what I would describe as a more realistic portrayal of a person, up until the moment where she runs backstage and she cries and says, oh, why do I, you know, fall for this stuff? Because nobody says that. Nobody. And I didn't find that convincing. And there is the quick retort from the head costume lady where she says, oh, it's because you're a woman. And it's like, is that a joke? Like, is that supposed to be like a comedic timing kind of a thing? Like, this is very weird. But it's one of those things where Naomi Watts, like, was an anchor in this film, like, where everyone else is just acting like such larger than life characters.
Yeah, she does kind of seem to be outside of the loop of delusion, doesn't she? She seems to be like an actor and a normal human being who isn't struggling with this identity problem or this manic delusion.
No, well, she does have identity problems in that she's associated herself with needing to be somebody who's around Edward Norton.
Well, she has the problem of being somebody who wants to have, quote unquote, made it, and then, you know, as a Broadway actress. And that's sort of like a level one version of somebody who has issues with their career as like an actor. But she's not even close to on par with the insanity that ensues from Michael Keaton and Ed Norton.
Yeah, level one. You know, you gotta level up. You gotta get the experience points from, you know, grinding through the levels, you know, that stuff.
In the Birdman video game.
Yeah, roll for initiative. The Birdman tabletop experience. But the I'm sorry, I had to make a joke. That was like the first time I made a joke in, you know, 20 minutes. This is another thing about this film. Even when it's trying to be funny, I feel like it is horribly oppressive. Like, this film is not funny in a way that one might expect a film about a former superhero that is doing a Broadway play and is all shot in one take might be. Now, I've read conjecture that it has to do with, you know,
it's tragic. It's tragic comedy as much. I mean, it's capital tragic, lowercase comedy. If I were to say anything, like, the humor just sort of furthers that depressing feeling that you get watching this guy's descent into madness. It's just like, oh, that's unfortunate. And he's just, you know, he's one step closer to that ledge, literally, at the end of the movie, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's another moment where, like, his delusion and the real world kind of meet. And there's a little bit of a hint for the audience where, you know, the Birdman is winning in his brain. And he's literally going to go jump off a building. And some guy behind him grabs his arm and snaps him back to reality for just a moment where he's got... You know, he's got a score and, you know, just dramatic music playing in his head, and he's about to jump off a freaking building. The guy's like, dude, are you okay? And he comes back to reality long enough to postpone his attempted suicide until he grabs a real gun.
Yeah, okay. But I didn't really, like, laugh, I guess, at the moments that I thought were supposed to be comedic. And maybe that is part of the grand plan, like you're saying, like it is... not really intended to be like a belly laugher, like kind of, you know, rolling on the floor, LOL, Rafflecopter kind of a situation, which is fine.
I definitely don't think it's that.
No, which is fine. It doesn't need to be that thing. But it felt like instead what I was hearing were things that were supposed to be funny, but I wasn't laughing, in some of the scenes and some of the situations. Now, I did laugh at the, you know, like, situation with his first scene where he's in his underwear and floating, and then there's the FaceTime call, which I'd be really, really curious to find out how that ages in the Criterion Collection 10 years, 20 years from now, when people are going back and watching this film, and they're like, What is FaceTime? What is happening?
I thought it was Skype, wasn't it?
You know, it was FaceTime, but for some reason, Emma Stone's character was holding her iPhone horizontally. So that was fascinating, but that's in the film. So
yeah.
that'll be there forever. The first couple seconds of the film. And it felt like that was supposed to be funnier than it was, but I mean, it was okay, I guess. The stuff
that establishing the relationship, at least.
Yeah, but the other stuff that came later, like the other little jokes and like the laughy humor stuff between them, where they are laughing at one another, it wasn't with them. Now, part of that might have been like I felt alienated from the film by all of the other dramatic stuff that wasn't appealing to me. So perhaps it's hard to get into the groove. But I wasn't laughing along at those points. So I don't know. I don't know. Maybe it's a situation where it's supposed to be like where it's written so that these characters are laughing because they think it is a way to relieve stress rather than actually being funny. But to me, it just felt like jokes that didn't land when they were trying to actually make jokes to sort of lighten their own moods. It's hard for me to say because since the surrounding stuff wasn't working, it's hard to judge whether or not that is really the intent of that particular moment. Like I said, the stuff with Naomi Watts, like it wasn't emotionally appealing, but it felt like she was reasonable. Stuff with Edward Norton as well as Michael Keaton, I feel are just so on the nose and so like what they are supposed to be. And I know Michael Keaton in real life is not like his character Riggan is in the film, but that's not what it comes across as. Like when I say like on the nose, like they're saying things to one another for what they're feeling is what I mean. And so it's just, and the character of the critic, I couldn't like her any less. And the ex-wife, she did not appeal to me. And not for her outlandishness, but she was sort of she was playing it understated, but delivering what should be perceived as like sort of profound lines, like the fact that she has the insight to articulate these thoughts in such a specific way on the drop of a hat, like you're saying with her earlier description of his need to be loved, but her performance is very understated, and then with you know, Zach Galifianakis, not being comedic and not being like as on the nose silly, but actually being sort of realistic-ish, I guess, which is sort of unusual in and of itself, but it the tone just was so weird, and it was in the writing and it was in the directing. And so it is very bizarre, and I couldn't connect to these characters, and these are the central characters we follow through, and, you know, along with Emma Stone as the very important character of the daughter of Michael Keaton. I did like how she was introduced in that we did not know that that was really his daughter at first. But I didn't like the shouting over FaceTime thing. I don't like, the scene where they fight. Basically any time they were shouting at each other didn't really work for me. I thought that they shared a nice moment, like you're saying, with the toilet paper thing and her substance abuse program. But that's just it, intellectually, it's not like a film where I feel like there is a clever, subtle thing occurring underneath the surface. I feel like all of it is on the top, with especially the metaphors and with the characters knowing things that they should say to one another, and with the comedy and with the tragedy and with everything. I feel like it is a very surface level thing, and I wish it had been deeper. I wish it had gone further than where it went. You know, a lot of times people make fun of those Oscar films where, you know, characters don't say anything and it's just raining and they give each other like longing looks and they leave a room or whatever. And certainly there was none of that to be had here. But because they would just say, I'm going to leave the room. I wish there had been some subtext here or something. Like I felt like even the metaphors, like you're saying, are just, are literal metaphor, or, well, not literal, they're so exact to the situation specifically, that they don't wind up feeling like, something subtly woven in. It's like, hey, look at me. I'm important to his life. Every time a metaphor would come up in the film, every time a character would say something insightful or incisive about how he is living his life. It just culminated in a whole thing, not feeling to me intellectually appealing. But I've rambled long enough. So I yield the talking stick back to you.
I understand what you're saying, and I agree with a great deal of it. Like, I think the reason Zach Galifianakis is funny at all is because he's the most utterly desperate character in the entire thing. You know, the reason, you know, like, he's lying to Michael Keaton when he sees that Keaton has smashed up his dressing room, and he's like on the verge of like canceling it. And he says, you know, I don't think this is for me, and he's losing it. You know, he does what a producer does, and he lies to get his crew back on set. And it's kind of funny to watch, and again, that tragic way. But trying to think about why, again, this whole thing sort of resonates with me. You are right in that there is a lot of surface level stuff, and maybe it could be more subtle. But I think, you know, as a whole, the movie is a giant mess of like overwhelming emotion. And that just in every single instance builds and builds and builds on top of itself. And it just sort of perfectly illustrates this. You know, it's not that it all happens accidental to Michael Keaton's character. This is what he's actually trying to do. But the task at hand is so gigantic for any one human being. You know, again, the whole thing that Ed Norton kind of pokes fun at when he first sees him is, you know, that's ambitious. You're going to write, direct, and star in this thing. It's too much, basically. And it's going to destroy him mentally and emotionally, because at this point in his life and career, he's not really ready for it. And I think I have said in the past on the internet or in other places that this isn't necessarily a movie just for filmmakers, because anyone who has tried to make art can understand the blurring of the lines between art and self. But I'm going to recant on that slightly, because I'm realizing, as you're talking and I'm talking, that the majority of my understanding for his character comes from the few instances where I've been, like, on set actually directing a thing. And I end up in this manic state where I do my job and I get everything out of my mouth as I wanted to, and it's hard work. And at the end of the day, I go home and I have an adrenaline crash where I black out for like 17 hours. Like, I usually don't end up being able to get home long enough to like change my clothes. Like, I will black out on a couch for like 10 hours. And it's that sort of overwhelming emotion that I see building in this guy who's doing this thing that I watch, and it's like, this guy hasn't slept for 3 days. He's doing a play. He wrote it. He directed it. He's replaced an actor with this incredibly difficult jackass in Ed Norton, and all of these things on top of them. And I watch this and I go, my brain would explode doing all of that. And I can see that his brain is about to explode literally and metaphorically as well. And that's where I get this sort of understanding of, like, I can see what's happening to him. And again, maybe I don't have the empathy or the I don't feel happy or sad or laugh at the joke so much, but I'm watching this sort of massive train wreck of what for all intents and purposes is a project that isn't dramatically different than any other. It's a play, and they happen all the time, or movies happen all the time. But as I'm watching it, and just this giant ball of emotion that is about to hit Michael Keaton all at one time at the end of this movie is just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And I go, well, it's just, there he goes off a cliff. And I can see it coming. He can't. And that's the way the movie ends up. So maybe that's why I enjoy, and well, maybe not enjoy is the right word, but that's the reason why I understand and appreciate what's happening in it. But I can see where my personal enjoyment and appreciation is not something that I would share with a great many other people, because it's based on my personal experiences.
Okay, yeah, that is a good point you bring up there. Which, you know, might very well be, like, as we had talked about earlier, be something that Academy voters might identify with. The tremendous pressure from a very specific project, and they can recognize and see in this particular role, in some way, something they can personally connect to, the strife that the actor, the director feel in trying to pull off their one true chance at being a real artist. And not even that they need to impress the world for all of the reasons that he does, but just the fact that you need to prove yourself. Or you feel like you need to have an experience in which you have set upon the world some magnificent feat. This pressure,
and doubly so if, like, this is potentially your last shot at it, based on age or career or whatever.
Yeah, and I mean, candidly, we have both had discussions where, you know, we are in our in the twilight of our careers, where we're in our early 30s. So we're probably more prone to being negative and cynical about our career prospects as we once were in the halcyon days of 2005.
it's all downhill and Raymond Carver and handguns from here on out.
Oh, please no. I don't want that nose. But the I don't know. There is a tremendous amount of pressure, but I couldn't identify with the specific way in which this story was being communicated to me here. It didn't I can understand sort of similar things, but I've never been on a set and been through these experiences. I'm not a set person, obviously, as we've discussed. I should be kept in the shadows, the shot cobbler. For you, someone who has actually been on a set, on a live set, and had the adrenaline experience of needing to do something right away, or everything would just explode, and not just explode like, well, I guess we'll just get in early tomorrow and fix it. Like, explode. Like, you have to make sure that all of this is such a limited time window that you have to work, and such a limited time window you have to prove yourself, and you might miss a moment, and it won't be like an undo button on it. You gotta make sure that it happens. So perhaps that is what triggers it for you, is seeing some of those more similar experiences in here, while maybe more literal and not super deep and insightful, they still trigger something for you, like trigger warning, film stuff, trigger warning, theater stuff. But, you know, maybe that is what is speaking to you and not connecting with me, because I don't have that background. Perhaps like you're saying, with, you know, like most audience members don't have that background either. But in a way, I almost wish that perhaps this dialogue could have been a little less on the nose, and that people could have gotten more into what was happening here, and that it hadn't been so based on this very specific case of being like in a director actor situation, that it had more of not necessarily like a mass dumbed down appeal where it's like, you know, all of a sudden
it's
they're
not
like,
relatable.
Yeah, and I don't mean it needs to be like Michael Bay, like everybody's like a supermodel in the film, and like they're all just like, you know, breathy sighs, and the camera spins around them. The camera spins around everyone, literally, in this film. So
that is another thing. Now that you bring up Michael Bay, there aren't really any characters in this movie that normal people watching the movie would aspire to be either. Like, we're, you know, in the sense that in a Michael Bay movie, maybe we're aspiring to be the hero of the day or the supermodel of the day. The people in this movie are all tragically flawed in a great many ways, and I don't want to be any of them, especially the people who can't figure out that they are going to be their own downfall. I wonder if that is a big sticking point for people, because while I can see how these sorts of people are, you know, these sorts of traits are potentially more realistic than the Michael Bay characters, I don't want to embody any of these traits myself.
Oh no. And just to also reiterate what you're saying, and reinforce it from a different perspective, I don't object to the film because there's no one for me to root for. I have lots of experience watching lots of things where I've liked the project, even though I'm not supposed to root for the main character. A key example of this would probably be American Psycho, in which you are rooting against the main character. He's not someone you feel positively about, and that everyone in the film is also deeply flawed, and there is no redeemable human being to be had from that process. But it is a look at sexism and racism and the horrible things about human condition and the way we treat one another when we need to feel superior, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not going to go into it too much more than that, but like just to say that, you know, there are ways to watch and appreciate something where there's more depth to it and you're not necessarily like in charge of mergers and acquisitions or whatever. Like, I feel like maybe that this film is too specific a thing, in that because it so narrowly defines everything that happens in such a literal way and in such a very specific way in terms of tone, to requiring you have that onset experience in order to identify with it, that perhaps it is mostly geared towards those Oscar voters. And if it had been written not like, you know, not where there was a hero, not where there was anyone to root for or anything like that, where just in terms of there being subtlety in what they were saying and doing, where things weren't obviously on the surface, where things were not immediately accessible for what they were feeling and what they were thinking. And this is one of those things where it's actually kind of the opposite of what usually wins an Oscar, because, you know, in like, look at The King's Speech, which won Best Picture not too long ago, which I recently watched. I didn't think it was a bad film, but I did kind of think it was an Oscar award winning movie that was designed to win Oscar awards. You know, like it had the certain air of earning awards and credit by virtue of its subject matter and sort of the way it was constructed. And I feel like a lot of the ways that, you know, Birdman is, by virtue of the way it's constructed and by virtue of, like, we're supposed to put it on a pedestal and appreciate its construction and the way it was put together. and that is the reason why it wins an award, and that is the reason why it deserves the acclaim. But I can kind of see through it into, like, all of the different parts of that don't work and I don't like as much. And so it doesn't ring true as much as it doesn't ring true for me, and it feels like something that can speak more to the people that will vote for this thing, just as I feel like the King's Speech can speak more to the people that will vote for the thing, even though I thought it was okay. It's not really much of a point that I'm making there. It's just that I think it's one of those things where it's one thing to say the film is pretentious, but it's another thing to say, like, I think that it's not like sort of cynically pretentious. I think it is just very specifically designed around an idea of what an artist is and what art is, and how that should be expressed, and with all of these people telling each other what art is, and that is what the construction winds up being, that we can all turn and look and appreciate and say, oh, look at this artistic thing, because it says it's artistic. And you know, that's whatever. I've murdered that horse.
No. It makes sense, though. And I see what you're saying. And I should be clear right up front in saying that I hate the King's Speech for a number of reasons, not the least of which is because it beat the Social Network, which is a favorite of mine. Ring your bell for Fincher. Take a shot. But, you know, it is kind of, you know, in terms of trying to think of why they may have made a movie that is more Oscar bait is like the worst possible term to use for it, but in the sense that it was written by the director, and, you know, maybe he just wanted to write a personal story that is, maybe he felt some kernel of this from any movie he had made in the past, where, you know, he's struggling with success, or he's struggling with these emotions in his career, and he wanted to sort of make a story around that. Just inherently the fact that it came from him, it's going to relate more to the Academy voters than a movie that was potentially written by somebody else. So, but I don't know. I mean,
well, it was an interesting point you bring up there, where it's written, you know, by him, that it's his baby, and that maybe it is related to his personal experiences. He hasn't directed a superhero Marvel film. So I don't know where he gets that particular axe to grind, unless he is leveling a criticism at the other directors who have gone and done this, or if he is leveling a criticism at being approached by studios to do this and he has turned them down. That if perhaps this is a reaction on his part to the proliferation of those superhero movies that we had talked about, the CG spectacles, etc.
Well, I don't know about that. I would say that there's probably some level of personal material coming from the artistic integrity standpoint. I don't know if he has any personal axe to grind against superhero films, but I think there is something underlying this film when he's talking about trying to do something substantial or something real, and I think that had to have come from him.
Okay, well, then it makes it all the more peculiar, ignoring the superhero stuff, but it makes it all the more peculiar that he writes in a character of the critic, who is supposed to hate him and will ruin his film because reasons. Like that is a curiosity in and of itself. Does he feel that all critics are that way? Because, I mean, there's no other counterpoint in the film. Does he feel that it is not the critic's duty to look at what he does and criticize it? Or is he just saying that this one particular character that he wrote is flawed for this very specific reason, and that it has nothing to do with a wider industry, even though the character of the critic does talk about people like him and the industry like him and et cetera. They think they can be artists, but they really can't be. That seems more like the hurt feelings of a director lashing out at someone than it feels like a critique of the medium. Of critiquing, a critique of a critic,
yeah, the
critique-ception.
The critic part is probably one of the more subtle parts in the movie, at least for me. Not subtle in the sense that she is basically like the devil with a pitchfork running around, her character in that way. But the way she has this relationship with Ed Norton's character, where they are talking a lot of trash to each other and being very adversarial, but they also have this sort of mutual respect for one another, or at least she has a respect for him and the craft. And that's where she's sort of coming from when she just her initial reaction to Michael Keaton walking up to her is just to blow him off, because she doesn't have any reason to give him any of that respect that Ed Norton has apparently earned countless times through his performances. You know, she said she'll give him a bad review if he ever delivers a bad performance. And that's kind of the relationship they have established. It does seem that they went a little bit far with making her the big bad antagonist that he has to prove himself to. But it is in that moment, and maybe this is the reason they did it, that they need that moment to break Michael Keaton in this movie, because that's what that's where he has his mental snap, where he's officially about to jump off a building, because this thing that is important to him it's a foregone conclusion. It's going to fail because she has told him so, and he buys it because he's delusional and he's been up for 3 days and he's drunk. But that is a tough sell, because you need her to be terrible. You need to see a little bit of humanity in her in the sense that we see it in that first scene with Ed Norton. We can't spend much time with her, and we need that scene to hurt Michael Keaton enough that he's going to do something drastic. So, I understand that what you're saying, and I agree, she is way over the top, but they had to do something there, and I guess this is what they came up with.
Yeah, well, that all the more reason why it feels lazy to me is that if you're going to write in a character and give them the motivation of this person needs to just make this thing happen, then is that thing really that important in the film? How should I really be feeling about this if I can see that it was set up in this particular way, where it's just written to happen because it needs to happen? It's sort of a tautology. She needs to destroy him because she needs to destroy him, not for any particular reason. And then, like you're saying, he snaps and he has his like super ultimate delusion with the giant robot bird and the explosions and everything. And that, is supposed to be like peering into the world of what the cinema he's rebelling against is. And when I say he, I am both referring to Riggin, the character, and the director. That is supposed to be like, this is what you could be giving into right now. We could be doing this, and instead you're doing your little play thing. It's very weird, and we should wrap this up because this is going on very long, and we still haven't talked about the ending of the film.
All right, you want me to give you my 2 cents on what happens in this one?
Yes, 2 cents it for me, man.
All right, so yes, he snaps. He thinks he is going to fail. I personally believe, spoilers if you haven't figured it out by now, that when he shoots himself on stage, he dies. And in his last moments, or as the camera oh so dramatically tilts up into the spotlight, we move into the light, and the last scene in the hospital is in his head, where we see that the success that he wanted came true. He got his wishes. They saw the artistic integrity behind his thing. It was obviously couched in that very sort of critic way, where the title of the critic's article is still kind of a backhanded compliment, but that's just, that's besides the point. He's a success. The play is going to go on, quote, forever, because it's fantastic. He shot his nose off. He got a new nose. He goes into the bathroom. He sees Birdman there after he takes off his little medical bandages there, and Birdman looks very dejected and disappears. And at this point, he has proven to himself and to Birdman that the power that has been in him this whole time was not due to Birdman, it's due to him. He proved it because he succeeded in his goals, and as noted by the fact that he can fly without Birdman and when he jumps out the window. But that whole last bit there is just a delusion in his mind, because he wants to believe that he had succeeded in every little bit. And, his ex-wife is there, his daughter loves him again, he's a success, he did what he set out to do. And they even, Zach Galifianakis said, this is what you wanted, isn't it? And he said, well, yeah, I guess this is what I wanted. And that's where he has to reflect on whether or not this is actually what he wanted. But he achieved his goal, he proved his delusional self wrong, and he can fly away. But that's all in his head because he is dead.
Okay. My 2 cents is that it is an intentionally ambiguous ending. And so I don't weigh in on whether or not it is.
You jerk.
Well, no. But, you know, it's one of those things. You know, the ending to Inception or the ending to anything. It's like, well,
yeah.
If it is written on the part of the filmmaker to be ambiguous, and this is most certainly written to be ambiguous, this is not like, this is one of those things where you see people look it up on the internet afterwards, and it's like, how what was the ending of the film? How did was he dead or was he alive? And it's like, well, the answer is like sort of the quantum state of both things, because the filmmaker wants you to consider both possibilities. So yes, I do think you are absolutely correct, but correct in your assessment that he's dead. I do think that it is also possible that none of this really happened, that it was all a delusion, shooting himself in the face, what occurred as it did there, and the flying was a delusion, and just as all the other parts we saw of the film that were delusions. He's levitating in the very first scene of the film. So was he alive when he did that? Because that shouldn't have happened. His destroying things with his mind, like all that stuff. It's just like, well, it's ambiguous because it doesn't matter.
Yeah, there's enough delusion peppered in throughout the movie to make it questionable, especially when you get to the end and they've got this very rosy, glowy scene. And then, of course, he flies.
Yeah, yeah.
And, of course, on top of that, there are police sirens in the background once he goes out the window, too. So maybe he actually hit the pavement. But, you know, in that flying moment, again, the reason I think, you know, he's making it up is because that's where Emma Stone actually sees him for what he actually thinks he should be seen as in this sort of powerful character. So he actually succeeded in making her see that this whole thing he's been doing with his whole life, while it may have seemed like he was just wasting his time in his life, that she now appreciates it and blah, blah, blah. She's blown away. But anyway.
Yeah. So anyway, that is my answer. It is not a satisfying answer because it's not definitive. And I can't give a definitive answer because I feel like that is not the intention of the filmmaker to give a definitive answer. So ta-da, the end. And also, I didn't really care because at this point in the movie, I was pretty angry. So if he was dead, great. If he was alive, all the better. Stupid nose. But it is one of those things where, you know, you can spend all day hemming and hawing about, like, if he's alive, if he's dead, what part of this is real, what part of this isn't real. And it's like, well, that's not, and you know, I don't want to say it's a laziness on the part of the filmmaker, because it isn't. It's just an intention of the filmmaker that he doesn't spell it out, that you just consider both possibilities. So, you know, you just entertain all of the possible outcomes of the situation. So, it's sort of like, you know, you have to entertain all of these quantum states. Even though you saw stuff on the screen, you know that it can't realistically have occurred in the... according to the laws and rules of the universe that he is occupying in the film. So then it's just like, well, then I have to either accept that this is, I have to create my own rules for how I accept this thing and what are the rules that I'm going to, and you just wind up thinking about it, which is a fine goal for any filmmaker. Like, you know, Christopher Nolan got into like a world of hurt over this. And I don't know how I'm going to spoil this for anybody, but if you're really upset at spoilers, then tune out for like 30 seconds because it's gonna be quick. But that little top that spins at the end of Inception, like, oh, it wobbles right before we cut out. So does that mean it was gonna fall over? Does that mean that he was still in the dream world? Does that mean he was in reality? And guess what? You aren't supposed to know. Like, that is the intention of the filmmaker. There's no sequel to Inception. There's no Inception 2 where we find out that, you know, it was a dream or it wasn't. And, you know, there were all kinds of people upset on the internet about that because how lazy was that, according to them? And it's like, well, it's not lazy and it's not a cop-out. It is just the intention that you discuss this. Now, if you object to the idea that you should discuss the ending to a film and weigh all of the different possibilities for what could have occurred, then I would suggest that perhaps the film wasn't for you. But, and like in this case with Birdman, I am able to accept that there are alternate possibilities. I still think the film isn't for me. But that is one of those things where people would like to have a nice little neat bow tie on the end of it where it's just like, oh, well, this is definitively what happened. Or It's like, I don't know what they expect. They're going to go on the internet and they're going to find out the answer that they didn't see in the film. Like, what do you think's going to happen? Like, you're going to look it up and you're going to be like, oh, that's what happened. Like, I totally missed that. I totally missed that part. You're not going to find that. Like, this is not what the director doesn't make this movie so that you can go online and there's a webpage by the director that says, oh yeah, it was totes this. Like, that's not what happens.
Wouldn't be art if it did.
Oh man, that would be such a J.J. Abrams thing to do. But you know, it's just like one of those things where people need to have answers. Even Emmanuel, the cinematographer of this film, gave an interview, that one that I had talked to, we had talked about earlier, where there was the wipes and stuff. I can't remember what that was, but it's the same interview. The interviewer would ask him about the ending, and he's like, oh, well, you know, it's up to interpretation. It's whatever you want to see or whatever. Like, Americans are the ones that predominantly need to have a definitive answer, you know, and it's just a cultural thing. That he says that, you know, most other audiences, European audiences, et cetera, are more open to other possibilities at the ending of a film. And so that's fine. And he calls it like it is, and it is like it is. So. The end. It's all of the things you ever thought it could be is the answer.
Well, I will just point to the last line of the film where he's assumedly saying it to the delusional Birdman character sitting on the toilet. But the last line that Michael Keaton says is bye bye and F you. So I'm sticking with my theory. But yeah, it's all fair enough. Yeah, you got to maintain the magic, so you don't want to spoil the ending for people.
Yes. Well, you don't want to have the ending in your movie, because that would really spoil... No.
They shouldn't have told people that there was an ending to the movie at all, mm-hmm. and then people could be surprised by the magic, and then, you know, later they can tell people that there was actually an ending.
Could you imagine if you shot a two-hour movie, and you normalized it so that at the first frame it was full brightness, and then at the end of the movie it was at zero? It just got darker over time. Just
people
slow.
Would feel like they were losing their mind.
Just like, slowly got darker.
Am I having
darker.
A stroke, or is it getting dark in here?
Yeah. Well, I mean, because it would be one of those things where it would be over such a long period of time that it would just be slowly getting dimmer. And what if, like, the scenes that were occurring later were at night or something, and so it was just slowly getting darker? And so you just had no idea. And then by the end of the film, you're just like, I can't see what's going on. What's going on? And then there's
it's
nothing.
It's a good thing Andy
Kaufman
isn't making these kinds of movies. Because didn't he do that with a show where he had, like, the vertical roll in the TV show and people were banging on their sets?
No. I'm not objecting to that piece of information. I just don't know if that's actually correct.
I'm pretty sure it was in the Jim Carrey movie where he thought it would be funny to make people think their TV sets were broken.
Yeah,
you would totally have people complaining that the movie theater was, like, broken if it was getting dark.
I didn't see that movie for whatever reason.
It's not great.
Yeah, that's what I heard. So I didn't see it, but... and another little interesting factoid before we round this out. Of all of the Best Picture nominees for this past year, I saw exactly one. So I'm not sure what that says about me or my criticism or my ability to criticize anything, but that is a fact. It is true, 100% true, that I only saw one of the Best Picture nominees. And
let's see. I'm taking a look at the list here. I have seen...
I know you saw Grand Budapest Hotel.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I bought Boyhood, but I didn't get a chance to watch it before the awards ceremony.
Oh,
so
well, buying it counts. That's like half a point. So yeah, that's 2.5. What else you got?
I watched Inherent Vice recently. That was nominated for Wardrobe.
I'm talking about Best Picture only.
No, then no. I got nothing.
So you saw 2.5 of all of them.
2.5, yeah.
Yeah, and I saw one. So it's one of those things where... I don't know. Maybe we are not the audience that this is supposed to connect to. And so maybe that is why we can say these things, because we don't feel the way that we ought to feel, because we haven't achieved whatever it is by seeing all of the other films that it's up for. You know, perhaps all of the other things that are up for Best Picture nominees were not as good as this. Who knows? I don't know. I can't see the other things. I know that many people complain that Boyhood didn't win. I have no personal feeling on this because I didn't see it. And so I'm not objecting to the idea that Birdman could win from that group. I still don't like the movie. The end.
The end.
And how?
Thank you for an honest performance, Joe.
Okay. You're welcome. And then I shoot myself in the nose, right?
No, don't do that.
God, this movie. Anyway, we're done.
Mm-hmm. I had some follow-up stuff that we didn't talk about if you want to do post-show, or we can save it.
Okay, we'll put it after the music. After the
sure.
The god-awful drum music in this movie.
I didn't think the drums were that bad.
It bothered me. It was just like just random percussion. I know it's jazz music. I don't like
it. It was used you know, in different places with different tempos for different reasons.
Bum 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 bum. Yes, it's great.
We don't even need music. We'll just put that at the end.
Oh, please don't. But what's your follow up for the post show? The
we didn't mention Rob Lewis's Ultraviolet post.
Oh yes, Rob Lewis, friend of the show. After immediately listening to our episode, it seems, and reading my very long and ranty blog post, or at least the part of it that had to do with Ultraviolet, decided that he was going to take it upon himself to venture out into the cold, bleak world of discs that he already owns and see which one of them had an Ultraviolet code on it. Turns out it was the Lego Movie, which is a Warner Brothers film. So no big surprise there, because my complaints and your complaints all centered on Warner Brothers and sticking with Ultraviolet. He attempted to redeem that code for 40 minutes and finally did. He had to set up different accounts, because you need to have an Ultraviolet account and you need to have a Flickster account, and you need to confirm your email address, and there's a whole thing. It'll be in the show notes. It is magnificent that he went through all this trouble, but I want to emphasize that it was trouble. It is no trivial feat to go through 40 minutes of this to get a digital copy of a film that you have on a physical disc. It is stupid.
Seriously, I get pissed off after 10 minutes with iTunes, and I just resort to whatever I've got to do to watch a movie.
Yeah, and then you had all of those unopened discs that you bought because you were just like, maybe I'll watch this someday, and you still haven't. And some of those, you've even told me that you've purchased again digitally. You have duplicates of these. And I even asked you, like, can you go through those and see if any of them have an Ultraviolet code to do for research for the show? And what was your response?
Why would I do that? I don't want to watch Ultraviolet movies. I don't want to watch Blu-rays. I don't want to get off my couch and rummage around through dusty things on a shelf.
Yeah, getting off your couch is the worst. But this is one of those things where it also came to light the fact that I also don't own any discs. I own fewer HD, DVD, and Blu-ray discs than you do, in that I know that I own zero. I own DVDs, but that is where my disc collection stopped. I never went down the path with it, because there were two competing formats when I could have very well purchased a player. I didn't feel like I was going to get a lot of bang for my buck at the time. And I was like, it'll be cheaper in a few years anyways. And now that
I'm the dummy that bought both players.
Yeah, well, I wasn't going to say it that way. But now that it's cheaper, I have no desire, no impulse to pursue it. I don't want it. I would much rather just, you know, like have digital files just float through the ether and just have them available whenever I want. Mm-hmm. You know, Netflix streaming is inconsistent and weird. And then, you know, the rest of the time you just get something off of iTunes as a rental or as a purchase. And, you know, if you want to gift something to somebody on that, the system works totally fine too. I've done that like 5 times or something, for the last Starfighter. But the, you know, I mean, I'm very glad I don't own a copy of The Ice Pirates on HD, but I got to see it on HD. That's all the utility that I need from the device. I don't need to go scrounging through bins like I used to in college and look for DVDs that are on sale for $9 at Walmart, because that was what you used to do in college. And you used to find a good deal on something that was a classic that was out on disc, and you'd get it and you'd watch it until you you know, very well burned a hole through it. You'd go buy the box sets for things. You buy the director's edition, the collector's edition, the ultimate cuts, all of the stuff, the extended unrated version. And you'd get all this stuff and you would watch it and you know, maybe poke through the special features once or twice, which usually weren't that special, which is another reason why purchasing DVDs and purchasing discs has really trailed off. And that most of the time it's either digital these days or sometimes with Redbox, even though Redbox is also declining.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or if you do actually buy a disc, you end up like me, whereby you get your nice new pristine copy of the re-release of Die Hard, and your Blu-ray player asks for a software update and then says, sorry, this disc isn't a Blu-ray disc, so throw it away.
Yeah, or HDCP errors and stuff. I mean...
Oh, yeah, that's always fun.
The whole system's stupid. Burn it down. No, but it's good to highlight Rob's post. We thank him very much for his efforts. Way to go, Rob.
Good job.
A plus.